You're listening to the free edition of Sweden in Focus from The Local. If you would like to listen to a full-length version of the podcast, as well as an additional midweek episode, please check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade to Membership Plus. Here's this week's free edition.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Sweden in Focus, the Local's weekly news podcast. And we are recording this episode on Thursday, the 18th of January. This week, we're going to talk about a sensational find in northern Sweden of rare earth metals and what it means for Sweden and the wider world. We'll dig into Sweden's EU presidency and how we'll know if it's successful. We'll chat about a new sleeper train service from Stockholm to Berlin. We will listen to an interview with the ambassador of Malaysia to Sweden. We'll discuss how Sweden has reacted to furious Turkish complaints about the hanging of an effigy of President Erdogan. We'll examine an emerging debate about whether dual citizenship means divided loyalties. And since I'm re-recording this intro after the fact, I can say that we'll also talk about a state secretary's eel fishing scandal that has prompted calls for his resignation, as well as news stories about the sentencing of two brothers for spying and a new military aid package for Ukraine. I'm Paul Omani and I'm joined today by James Savage in Stockholm, Emma Lovegren in Simrishamn and Richard Orange in Malmö. Richard, welcome back. I mentioned last week that you're in a new role at The Local. Can you just tell us what you're doing now?
Yes, I'm the new Nordic editor, which is basically, it's a contributing editor who's going to bring some of the brilliance I brought to local Sweden over the last, how long was it? 10 months or something, to Norway and Denmark. So there's just basically more stories on the site, a bit more content, as they call it, to sort of bolster what those sites have. But so far, I've basically been hopping in to cover for Becky because she's vabbing. And I imagine there'll be quite a lot of that. So when the different editors and reporters are off, I'm just someone who is always going to be there to jump in. So they're not sort of scrabbling around to find freelancers. So basically, I'm more sort of Nordic's dog's body, I think, rather than Nordic editor. But that's what it is. So I'm really looking forward to it, actually, because I've edited the Norway site and the Denmark site in the past, and it's quite interesting to have that broader perspective and to be able to kind of compare and contrast between the different countries, yeah, which are very similar but also very different in their own ways.
You've had a fantastic year running The Local Sweden. We've attracted loads and loads of new members, hundreds of new members, thousands of new members. So I'm sure you're going to bring the same magic touch everywhere.
Definitely. Thanks for that, Richard. And how about the rest of you? James, Emma, anything new with you?
No.
God.
Nothing's happened here, really.
Jesus, I've got to have a more interesting week next week.
No, that's fantastic. We can just skip the small talk and get straight into the rest of
Excellent.
The podcast. Let's do it. So the European Commission came to Kiruna in northern Sweden last week to properly kick off Sweden's stint as host of the rotating European Union presidency. And while they were there, the Swedish government and the LKAB mining company announced that miners had found Europe's largest deposit of rare earth metals. How significant is this find, Emma?
It's pretty significant. The EU basically it wants to phase out new vehicles that emit carbon dioxide by 2035. And that's just in over a decade, which will effectively ban the sale of new cars that rely on petrol and diesel. And instead, they want to transition into fossil fuel production, for example, electric cars. And these metals that have been found, they're used in the manufacturing of electric cars. And also like other green energy stuff, like wind power turbines, for example. So they're essential to the so-called green transition, as politicians like to call it. And at the same time, the EU, for perhaps obvious reasons, doesn't want to be dependent on third countries like Russia, like China. And especially the latter, they currently produce a lot of the raw materials that are needed for this sort of thing. Like the EU's current demand for rare earth metals, it gets met entirely by imports from other countries, and mainly China. So in that sense, the fact that this find was discovered in an EU country is a massive boost for Swedish and EU leaders. Similar deposits have been discovered there, so this is not the first find, but it's by far the biggest one so far. If we were to start mining this, it would put Sweden exactly where it wants to be, which is at the forefront of climate and tech. I mean, it's not exactly a coincidence that it was announced when the entire Swedish government and the entire European Commission just happened to be in Kiruna.
Oh my goodness, what are you suggesting, Emma? When does Sweden expect to be able to start extracting these rare metals?
It will take some time, Paul. So the next step for LKAB, I'm going to say LKAB because that's how you pronounce it in Swedish. So the next step for them now is to submit an application for exploitation concession, which basically means that they will be able to investigate the conditions for mining to see whether it's feasible at all to mine it sustainably and to mine it profitably. So they expect that it will take at least 10 to 15 years before they can actually make use of this deposit.
Mm.
And LKAB, actually, which is owned by the Swedish state, it's a really interesting company because in many ways it really is leading the way in the green transition, along with a bunch of other northern Swedish companies. Like, for example, they've said that they want to invest 400 billion Swedish kronor up until 2040 to switch all of their production from iron ore pellets to carbon-free sponge iron. And as I mentioned, rare earth metals like the ones that they found here can also be used to produce environmentally friendly products. On the other hand, it's also hard to argue that mining in itself does not have an impact on the environment. Like, they're currently in the process of literally moving the city of Kiruna 3 kilometers because it's no longer safe for it to be where it is because of the mine. And there have also been several conflicts between the Sami community, that's the indigenous people in Scandinavia, and the mining industry in northern Sweden because it threatens their reindeer herding. So let's just say that I wouldn't expect the permit application to go through completely without a hitch.
The thing about LKAB that I find is extraordinary, this their green iron ore project, is that if it goes through, it will mean 35 million tons of carbon dioxide less is emitted a year, which is, people don't understand how huge that is. I mean, that's the entire annual emissions of a country like Switzerland in like one company's project, which I just think is gobsmacking that you can make such, you know, every single person in Switzerland, everything they do, that amount of emissions will be reduced if they switch to green iron ore, which I think is amazing.
But it also really shows that, you know, that Sweden's status as a country with a lot of heavy industry means that it does also have, you know, a huge responsibility as well to take a lead in the climate transition.
We'll add links in the show notes to articles about this potentially very lucrative find. And we'll also link to an earlier episode where we talked about this issue that you just mentioned, the history of discrimination of the Sami people and Sami herding rights. So Sweden has been at the helm of the rotating six-month EU Council presidency since the 1st of January, which is why the Commission was up in Kiruna in the first place. But what does the EU presidency actually entail? What are the main items on the agenda? And how will Sweden know if it's been a success? To answer these questions and others, I had a chat this week with Louise Bengtsson from the Swedish Institute for European Policy Studies, and I started by asking her what the agenda looks like for the next few months and what kind of challenges Sweden faces.
The agenda is packed. One reason is because of the timing in the legislative cycle. So there will be elections to the European Parliament and a new commission in 2024, which means that a lot of files, as they say in Brussels, are now up for like final negotiations. So there are over 300 issues and 2,000 meetings that Sweden will have to deal with. So there's already quite a lot. The Commission is also very active and it keeps proposing new things, of course, related also to the fact that we're in the middle of a situation of war on European territory.
And how will Sweden know in June if its presidency has succeeded?
I think this is a really interesting question, because there are many layers to it. Of course, in Brussels, Sweden will be judged on whether it has moved the common agenda forward. This is the main task of the rotating presidency. Yeah. And from that perspective, it's a little bit of a glorified, chairman position that we have. So we just need to focus on muddling through and, building our network capital for the future, as good diplomats. So that's a very important aspect. And of course, there's always a temptation for national leaders to also pick some domestic points if we managed also to put the Swedish mark on the presidency. But I think politicians are also very aware that during the presidency, the role as honest broker is very much what is expected. So there's not too much room for those kind of initiatives if they're not framed in the European interest, in the European general interest, and something that more or less everyone will welcome.
And Ulf Kristersson has talked about support for Ukraine, that being possibly the most important challenge and the most important indicator for success. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, you're completely right, of course. And I think so far the general assessment is that we're quite surprised to the extent, that we've seen so much unity. But of course, if sanctions, for instance, or if certain responses start to affect member states in an asymmetrical way, then it can be more difficult to maintain unity. So this will be probably the most important task, of course, for the presidency. But as I said, it's not only up to Sweden there.
I'm just curious about some sort of facts and figures. You talked about how the presidency has a kind of diminished role compared to how it used to be. But does it cost Sweden a lot of money, and are a lot of civil servants involved in making it as smooth as it can be?
This is, of course, a big cost, but it's also a big investment for Sweden, as I said, because if we manage well and if we've prepared well, this will be to our advantage later on, because we built good diplomatic relations that can serve us later on. I know that the fact that the informal ministerials are mainly taking part in this conference center in Arlanda, close to Arlanda, has been mentioned as kind of a measure to save money.
Yes.
It's cheaper, I suppose, to organize everything there. On the other hand, maybe the Kiruna trip that the commission just did also probably cost a lot of money. So I don't know.
Yeah, I read an article on that, and it might be what you're referring to. There was an article in Dagens Nyheter about the Arlanda Conference Center, and the article seemed to suggest that Sweden has a reputation as a bit of a cheapskate in Europe. Is that true to say?
That's correct when it comes to our positions, when it comes to budgetary matters, of course. We've always been associated with these groups of frugal countries.
Yeah, frugal is maybe a nicer way of putting it.
Yeah.
And in terms of how many people are involved in the presidency?
So in terms of civil servants at the Perm Rep in Brussels, the Swedes have been reinforced approximately by 80 additional staff, which brings the total number of employees to around 200.
Okay, yeah, so that's quite a lot.
That's quite a lot. And then, of course, on top of that, all the additional reinforcements in Stockholm at the ministries. And also the agencies are involved, the Swedish myndigheter. Have quite a lot of work because of the presidency.
Yeah, so it's a big undertaking. Will there be a huge sigh of relief when it's all over?
I think so. I've heard that the presidencies are very intense. Once it's over, everyone will be very tired, I think, but hopefully also quite inspired. And the work continues, I suppose, for Sweden in the EU after this. So we're also hoping for a better debate in Sweden about European affairs, and we hope that the presidency can help to cast light on what's going on in Brussels.
Louise Bengtsson there from the Swedish Institute for European Policy Studies. And we also have an article with more from the interview that you can find in the show notes. A news emerged this week that Sweden's national rail company SJ or SJ is operating a sleeper service from Stockholm to Berlin from the end of March. Can you, Richard, tell us a bit about how this is going to work and how much it will cost?
Yes, well, it's basically an extension of the service they launched last September from Hamburg to Malmö. So it will leave Stockholm at 5:30 in the afternoon or evening. and it will stop at Hamburg Central Station at the bright and early time of 6 a.m. So, you know, you've got time for a leisurely breakfast before your business meeting. And then it will arrive in Berlin at 9 a.m. So you can still get to business meetings on time. So it's pretty convenient. And then on the way back from Berlin to Stockholm, it's about an hour later. So it leaves Berlin at 6:30 p.m., calls in at Malmö at 10 p.m. and then arrives in Stockholm at just before 10 a.m. in the morning. So it's really, I mean, it's a complete game changer for no-fly travel between Stockholm and the German capital. I mean, it's, if you manage to get a good night's sleep, it's easier than flying. We don't know exactly how much it's going to cost, and SJ has this demand-based pricing, so it varies depending on... there are cheaper tickets that sell out earlier, but the Hamburg-Stockholm stretch tends to cost a bit more than 1,000 kroner for a one-way ticket at the moment. And you can get it a bit cheaper if you book as soon as tickets are released. So I imagine it'll be slightly more than that, but probably not much more than that. It starts at the end of March and you can buy tickets. I think tickets are going on sale in February.
Okay. Excellent. And are you tempted to try it? I know you have recent experience of taking a night train from Hamburg to Malmö that you mentioned, and we'll put a link in the show notes for anyone who wants to read about your trip. Did it give you a taste for more, or did it put you off?
No, it definitely gave me a taste for more. I mean, it was super convenient. It actually really saved our bacon, because we were otherwise going to have to spend the night in Hamburg Station, which, if anyone's been there at night, is not the nicest place to to be with two small kids. But yeah, I mean, if you've been on a couchette carriage, if you're old enough to have been on a couchette carriage in the 80s, or you've taken an SJ sleeper from Stockholm to Malmö or Stockholm to the north of Sweden, it's exactly like that. It's a standard 6-berth sleeper with, you know, nice fresh white sheets that you have to put on yourself. It's pretty comfortable. And if you, as long as you don't, I mean, with these couchettes, a lot depends on, in my experience, a lot depends on your fellow travellers. I mean, sometimes I've been on couchettes where there's been somebody who's like definitely mentally ill in the couchette next to me screaming all night, or there's people getting pissed in the cabin next to you. But generally, we all slept really well. The staff were brilliant as well. There's definitely a sense of adventure getting a night train, I think.
One thing that struck me, Richard, reading your article was that you were awoken by border guards in Denmark.
Yes. It's about midnight that they get across the Danish border. All you have to do is like reach under your pillow and grab the passports and kind of wave it at them. And then they look at them and go on their way. They weren't making everybody come out and show their faces or anything like that. But I know what you mean. When I found out that they were going to do that, I was a bit upset, seeing as we were getting up at 3:50 in the morning in Malmö.
It's just a sign as well of how completely Schengen has broken down.
Yeah.
That, you know, it sounds very, very 1980s Central Europe, getting woken by border guards on a night train. Yeah, it would be nice if the EU could try and reinstate Schengen properly and get rid of border guards at crossings between Schengen countries. That's the point.
On now to the latest in our series of interviews with ambassadors to Sweden. And today it's the turn of Malaysia's Nur Ashikin Maud Taib. This interview is particularly timely, as this was, in fact, her last week in the role. So a good time to listen to some of the insights she has gleaned from 4 years in Sweden on everything from why there are so many hardware stores in Sweden to the difficulties of observing Ramadan in such northerly latitudes. And I started by asking her how many Malaysians there are in Sweden.
Well, we have about 900 over registered Malaysians in Sweden, but I was told that the numbers could be easily, could easily go up to about 2,500.
Okay,
because, yes, there have been many Malaysians who relocated here over the years. There are many Swedish companies in Malaysia. We have about 100 Swedish companies in Malaysia. So many of them came and worked for the Swedish companies and decided to stay on. Yeah. And some came, for love. They got married, settled down here and raised their families.
So can you tell us a little bit about bilateral relations between Malaysia and Sweden?
Our relations are very good. Our relations was established in 1958, right after Malaysia got its independence in 1957. So I always say that, Sweden is our development partner. So Malaysia now is a high middle income country, And, you know, much of our development is due to investments and trade by countries like Sweden.
And is there much trade between the countries?
Yes, well, not as much as we would like to, but trade is about, the trade figures is about $1 billion in 2021. Sweden is our 10th trading partner among the EU countries. Right. So, but overall, it's the 45th trading partner for Malaysia.
So you've been here, as you said, for 4 years now. What would you say is the one thing that you found most surprising after moving to Sweden?
Well, there are many things, actually. Sweden ranks very highly, you know, in many in the indices, right? But I think for me, it's the cost of living. The labour charges are very high and people do things themselves. Yeah. And then soon, then you know, we see so many hardware stores and all that. And after living here for a while, we realise why. So I think it's quite similar in other countries in Europe, but more so here. I mean, things are very expensive, you know, to get a haircut is very expensive. So my husband, you know, he goes bald because he says it's most cost effective.
I can really relate to that.
So otherwise, surprising things, well, looking at how the work-life balance here, mm-hmm. and how flexible the working environment is, especially during the COVID, people could work from home, and they are disciplined about it. Yeah. You know, there's this high level of trust. Yeah. So what I find surprising also is in terms of how people deal with sick leave. Because in Malaysia, you know, when you are sick, you see the doctor and you get a sick leave. Yeah. You know, but here you can just call in and say you're not well, and then you have the social security taking care of things.
And similar to the previous question, what's the best thing about living in Sweden?
Oh, I think it's the fresh air, clean water, and the calmness. You know, it's an important city, but it's quite laid back in a sense. Yeah, yeah, and things work. Yeah, I think that's what I would remember most about Stockholm, and how beautiful it is in the summer. Yeah. Another thing that was that took a while to get used to is the short days in winter and the long days in summer. Yeah, for us who observe the Ramadan, so it was quite difficult in the past few years because the days were very long. So we were fasting for about 18 hours. Yeah, so now it's getting better.
That's really difficult. I mean, have you ever tried to go to the north of Sweden during Ramadan?
No, I haven't. That would have been difficult.
Thank you very much for joining us on Sweden in Focus.
You're most welcome. Thank you very much.
That was the outgoing Malaysian ambassador Nur Ashikin Maud Taib, and we wish her well in her future ventures as she departs Sweden. If you'd like to hear more of her thoughts and insights, we will have a longer write-up of the interview on the site in the coming days.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Towards the end of last week, a group called the Swedish Solidarity Committee for Rojava dangled an effigy of Turkey's President Erdogan by its feet from a lamppost near City Hall in Stockholm. In a video, the group explained that this was a reference to Benito Mussolini and was meant to illustrate how dictators end their days. And this incident has further complicated the saga of Turkey's refusal to ratify Sweden's NATO application. James, can you tell us a bit about how this has played out in terms of the official Swedish and Turkish reactions and how the Swedish foreign minister's intervention is being viewed domestically?
Right, well, this Rojava Committee, it's a Kurdish group that's been highly critical, unsurprisingly, of Turkey and Erdogan. Now, the reaction to this has put the Swedish government in a difficult position, because obviously Sweden is trying to suck up to Turkey so that Turkey will approve its NATO membership. Foreign Minister Tobias Billström was straight out on Twitter. He condemned the stunt as abhorrent and pointed out that Erdogan is a popularly elected president. Ulf Kristersson, the Prime Minister, also condemned it. He said it was a sabotage against the Swedish NATO application and put Swedish security at risk. Now, these statements received a furious response from some free speech advocates in Sweden, including Nils Funke, who's seen as the granddaddy of free speech in Sweden. He said it was wrong of ministers to condemn actions that fall within the bounds of free speech. He was saying that ministers were basically going beyond their remit. Some legal experts, though, disagreed with him, including a former head of legal at the foreign ministry, and said that that's a bit of a fundamentalist attitude, that ministers are able to say things. What they're not able to do is to use their power to restrict free speech.
Right.
Unsurprisingly, the Turks weren't happy with the Swedish response either. They said it didn't go far enough. Words weren't enough. Erdogan's spokesman demanded that the action was taken against the groups. And the Swedish ambassador in Ankara was summoned to the foreign ministry for a dressing down, as often happens in diplomatic disputes. Also, a trip to Ankara by the Speaker of the Swedish Parliament, Andreas Norlén, was cancelled. Now, on the issue of legal action, Swedish prosecutors did receive a complaint of defamation, but they looked into it and they decided not to prosecute, and saying that the actions didn't fulfil the criteria for defamation. Anyway, what's the upshot of this? Well, it certainly hasn't moved Sweden's NATO application forward, and it may have moved it back a bit, but it's perhaps not the most significant event in Sweden's NATO application this week. What's perhaps more significant is a visit by the Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu, not to Sweden, but to Washington, where one item on the agenda is Turkey's desire to buy American F-16 fighter jets. This is an issue that some in Congress want explicitly to be linked to the issue of Sweden and Finland's NATO accession. So the question is how far the US is prepared to push the issue and risk the arms deal, and how determined Turkey is to resist that pressure.
I don't think necessarily that the fact that they commented on the Erdogan effigy is that strange. Like, if somebody had done a mock execution of a Swedish party leader, like, you would have expected fellow party leaders to have opinions about that and condemn it. What was the most striking to me was the fact that they also published an official statement on the foreign ministry's website condemning it. And it used, like, extremely strong language as well. Like, the foreign minister's statement, it called it reprehensible, shameless act. And that's kind of unusually strong language, isn't it, for Swedish politicians, or Swedes in general. Like, I don't think that they would use such strong language even if it had happened to a Swedish party leader. Like, they would say things like, this is not okay. And all Swedes would take that to mean reprehensible or shameless, but they wouldn't actually use those words. So it's pretty clear that this was written not for the domestic audience, but to appease Turkey, basically.
There was another Turkey-related story this week that has nothing to do with NATO. It relates to the new Centre Party leader-in-waiting, Muharrem Demirok, who has dual Swedish-Turkish citizenship, but has now decided to renounce his Turkish citizenship. What do we know about this story?
It's a really interesting story. What happened was a reporter at Aftonbladet, Peter Kadhammer, who's, you know, a veteran left-wing reporter and commentator, he dug into Mure, as he's called, Mure Demirok's background, and managed to find out that he was still a Turkish citizen. And then he wrote a story revealing this, and he wrote what I found a terrifying article. He started it off saying, you know, I don't mean to question his loyalty, and then carried on to question his loyalty in every possible way, sort of saying, you know, Turkey demands that its citizens, you know, uphold the honour of the nation, and you can be put in jail for insulting Erdogan if you're a Turkish citizen. And he said the same about China and the same about Russia. And his argument was, he said, what I found most chilling, he said, you know, in a time of open borders, the idea of dual citizenship sounds very nice. But in today's more sort of dangerous times, is it still appropriate? And that logic I find very frightening as a dual citizen myself, because I can really see the debate changing in Sweden and also in other countries in Europe, also in the UK, to see dual citizenship as somehow having dual loyalties and therefore not to be trusted and eventually abolishing it, which would
or
be
putting so many restrictions on dual citizens that it becomes impractical. So, would you ban dual citizens from having certain roles in the public sector, for example? There are some roles in the public sector where right now you need to be a Swedish citizen to get the job. But would you extend that to say, well, Swedish citizen and not a dual citizen to get the job? And then it puts people in an invidious position, because I think, you know, having to choose between citizenship it's a very difficult thing to do. If you have to choose between being able to vote in the country, for instance, and have a permanent right to live in that country, or giving up the right to perhaps one day go back to your country of origin and, for instance, look after aging parents for an extended period. You know, to have to choose between those things puts people in a very, very difficult position. There are good reasons why in a globalized world, why dual citizenship is a thing.
Now, let's see if the Sweden's business and energy minister is prepared to give up her Norwegian citizenship.
Indeed, Ebba Busch is a Norwegian citizen too, and also she's deputy prime minister. Indeed,
right? Yeah.
You know, in Germany, for instance, where they still ban dual citizenship, they have always made it possible for people within the EU from other EU countries to have dual citizenship together with German, but and people outside the EU, that's been impossible. So and now they're just about to change it and liberalise the system.
I think it's really interesting with Germany that a lot of their rules around migration and citizenship are going in a more liberal direction, just as Sweden is going the other way.
Denmark too. Denmark is also liberalising its migration rules after having incredibly strict rules, bringing incredibly strict rules over the last sort of 20 years or so. They're now saying, you know, our businesses can't get workers, people can't bring their families to Denmark, and they're pushing the other way. It's interesting to see. It's quite, in a way, it brings a bit of hope to me, because it seems like there is a sort of a shape of this kind of populist wave, anti-immigration sentiment, and then it does seem like it's a wave that will, you know, that there is a future where it gets easier again, where the opinion changes and we move maybe in a more globalised, open direction.
Will Sweden have to lose its tech companies before it starts to realise that it needs immigration, and that immigration isn't all about charity, it's about also self-interest?
Did any of you see the story about PM Nilsson, who's one of the Prime Minister's closest aides, formerly a leader writer? He was appointed by Ulf Kristersson after the election. Did you see the story about him being fined this week?
What happened?
For what?
I saw something on Twitter, but I haven't got on top of it.
He was fined for illegally fishing for eel, which is an endangered species. So yeah, he was out fishing with all this specialized equipment, and the authorities, I can't remember the name of the agency, it's called Hafs and something Myndigheten, they sent one of their boats out and intercepted him and sort of confronted him and said, is this your eel fishing equipment?
And he said,
no, it absolutely is not.
No.
I would have loved to have been there when he got caught. Like, I'm sort of picturing him out in his little boat at dawn, secretly fishing for eel, and then suddenly this big boat shows up, flashing light. Boom, boom, you're under arrest.
And he's a very good-looking, striking man. I once met somebody who described him as panique snig.
What, because you get into a panic when you meet him because he's so...
He's so
hot.
Handsome and hunky. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No comment.
It is actually an extremely bad thing to do, because eels are the most extraordinary animal, and they are about to die out.
Yeah.
And it's you are actually still allowed to fish them if you are one of a descendant of historic eel fishers. Like, there's these group of families in Skåne on the eel coast around Aarhus who can fish with impunity.
No.
Because it's seen as part of their heritage.
We should point out, though, that this all happened in 2021, so it was sort of early autumn 2021 when he was out fishing, and he was later phoned up by the Karlskrona police in December of that year. And he denied everything there as well. But he sort of thought about it over the Christmas period, and his conscience got the better of him. And he phoned up his contact at Karlskrona Police and admitted everything. So two stories have broken while we've been recording. Can you fill us in on the details, James? Let's start with the verdict from Stockholm District Court in the case of the two brothers accused of spying for Russia, a case we spoke about in more detail a few episodes ago, and we'll post a link back to that episode in the notes. How has the court ruled?
Both brothers have been convicted. Peyman Kia, who's 42, who had served in both Sweden's intelligence service, Säpo, and intelligence units in the Swedish army, was given a life sentence for spying. The younger brother has got 9 years and 10 months, which is just slightly less than the prosecutors wanted. They wanted 12 years for him. But this will be considered as a significant victory for the Swedish police and prosecutors.
Okay, good. Thanks for that. And the second story concerns Sweden's delivery of arms to Ukraine. The government has previously said that it would send Sweden's advanced Archer artillery systems, and we've now got more details about the next planned military aid package. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so what we know they're definitely going to send is 50 combat vehicle 90s, which is a sort of, not quite a tank, but probably the sort of thing that would look to you and me like a tank. So that will be sent to Ukraine, 50 of those, and some more NLAWs, these anti-tank, portable anti-tank missiles. When it comes to the Archers, there's less detail on that. They say that they are going to send Archers, or they've given the Swedish Defence Forces the job of preparing for the delivery of these of this Archer artillery system, which is one of the things that Ukraine most wants from Sweden. So there are two kinds of Archer. There's one that the Swedish army uses, has in its sort of active arsenal, and then there's a second kind of Archer that's in reserve. And it's this second kind of Archer, the B Archer, that's in reserve that they are looking at sending to Ukraine. But Pål Jonson, the defence minister, he said he wouldn't be able to say at this stage how many Archers will be sent.
Great, thank you. And we'll be writing up those stories on the site, and we'll put the links in the show description when they're ready. And that's all for this week. Thank you for listening, and thank you to our guests, Louise Bengtsson and Noor Ashikin Modtaib. Our panellists this week were Emma Lovegrain, Richard Orange and James Savage. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. I'm Paul O'Mahony, and we'll be back again with a new episode of Sweden in Focus next Saturday. Until then, take care.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
That's all for this week's free edition of Sweden in Focus. If you'd like to hear a full-length version of the podcast each week, as well as an additional midweek episode with more interviews and analysis, please upgrade to Membership Plus. Make sure to check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade. Sweden in Focus is a podcast by The Local Europe. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. The publisher is James Savage.